You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, everyone, super excited about this episode today. We're getting the opportunity to speak with Craig and Jerry from RIP Medical Debt, a company that was founded in 2014, 5 years later, is approaching $1 billion of medical debt forgiven, $900 million, I think, to date. This is incredible. Two guys, they worked in debt collection, saw a broken system, was looking for a way to have an impact and make a difference, came up with this solution, close to $1 billion in medical debt forgiven. I think with this episode, we're going to be able to explore, one, the purpose, the impact that they're trying to have with this foundation. And then two, at an actionable level, we realize that there's people that are being crippled under the weight of medical debt. Provide some solutions before it goes that far. Provide some actionable tips that you can take with you. If you're dealing with medical debt, if you have a loved one, a friend, a family member that needs this information, someone listening to this needs this information, this is going to be an incredibly valuable use of your time. To help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. Yeah, I have been looking forward to this for some time. RIP medical debt came to my attention when I was back home in New York reading the newspaper, and I saw this incredible article about this not-for-profit that was basically paying off medical debt for a penny or pennies on the dollar. So you talk about outsized impact, and you look at how can I get 100x return on something and do something good in the world? Alarm bells just started ringing for me of how amazing this was. And I knew we had to get in touch with them. And yeah, months down the road, we are really fortunate to welcome Craig and Jerry to the show. So guys, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's start a little bit with your backstory, your why of this. Craig, start with you, I guess. You guys are working in debt collection. Like, what does that industry look like practically?
It's actually half of all collections in this whole country is medical debt. So it's strewn with people that can't pay their bills. If you collect about 12 to 15% in the collection industry, you are doing really well collecting against medical debt. I ran collection agencies in my 30 years of being in the collection business. So I knew what it was about. I personally didn't like the business, but I made money and I fed my family and stayed in it for 30 years. I'm only lucky that Jerry even introduced me to the concept of forgiving debt, because it's not what a debt collector does. They don't forgive debt. They collect it. So
it's against our nature.
It's against our nature. We don't. You know, I even went to, after we started this, I went to collection agencies and told them, hey, a lot of your accounts can't pay. Why don't you bring me into your hospital or your doctor's group? And they go, I can't do that. They'll think that I can't collect. I'm like, well, you can't. Well, I'm not going to tell my hospital that. They'll just kick me out and get someone else that will.
I find it, first of all, the work that you guys do is laudable. The idea of being financially independent. I'm in my 80s now. Even here in my 80s, I've never let an unencumbered breath come out of my lungs because of working to pay the bills, working to keep things together. Every one of the people listening to this know exactly what I'm talking about, paycheck to paycheck. Even though there were some very, very large paychecks, somehow or another, they managed to go to some very nice toys or just plain living. So I compliment you guys for helping put people on a track. Now, I'll tell you what gets them off the track. And that is, today, you guys may be, they may be financially independent, and they are one sickness, they are one accident away from financial tragedy. So a little bit of what Craig and I are going to be talking about today is not only what we do to sweep up after the parade, after these things happen to people, but to give you some ideas of what you need to do to be able to protect yourself. How's that sound?
Sounds amazing.
A very interesting thing is when you're looking at financial independence, $55 billion a year is lent to friends and family or gifted to friends and family for medical debt each year. So those people did not have financial independence. That's an astounding number. 36% of all crowdfunding goes toward medical debt. They actually didn't have financial independence. So what do you do to make sure that you do? Well, you can save money. You can pick out an HSA, health savings account. You can make sure that you know what your insurance covers. Most people have no clue. And a lot of the people that went insolvent had insurance. So just having insurance isn't enough. If you look at the amount of people, I think there's 68 million people in this country that are either underinsured or uninsured. Now, to be financially independent, you can't be underinsured. And the definition of underinsured means, is your deductible equal to 10% of your gross income? It's easy to tell. I have a $5,000 deductible. I make $52,000. Well, it's close to 10%. It's very simple to tell. You also have to know what poverty level you're at. Am I at 2 times the poverty level? 3 times the poverty level? Go to Google, look it up. It tells you. You put in how big your family is, how much you and your people in your family make, and it tells you what your poverty level is. So if you're 2 times the federal poverty level and below, you have to know right then, if I go to the hospital, I can get charity care, which will pay for every cent of my care, even if I have insurance. People don't know that.
Can I follow up on that just to tie some numbers to it? I realize there's probably some variables like family size, et cetera, but let's just say, you know, without the power of Google, that the federal poverty level is hovering around $25,000. So 2 times the poverty level would be around $50,000. So if your income is at 50,000 or below, maybe there's a pretty wide range there, but just for the sake of, you know, throwing something at the wall, you know, if that's where you're at, there's probably some significant services that are available that you may not have considered.
Oh, for sure. There's charity care. Every hospital, public or private, you know, nonprofit or for-profit, has a financial assistance policy. There's 5,800 hospitals. You just have to know what your hospital gives. Some of them are, if you make 2.5 times the federal poverty level and below, you will get charity care. So you have to know what your hospital is and you have to know what level you're at. I mean, a third of all people in this country make less than 2 times the poverty level. One third, but only about 3 to 5% of all hospitals' expenses go toward charity care. So people are missing it. It's an opt-in policy. It's not an opt-out policy. If it was an opt-in policy, we'd have 15 million people getting it instead of the number that do.
You know, it was a struggle for us. I want you to know, we're professionals in this world. We understand how people get into debt. We understand, frankly, all too much. If we ourselves have a problem working through the system, how in the world can your listeners at the wonderful age of 30 to 40 or under and over be able to understand the Greek in which most of these rules seem to be written, much less a price transparency, which is not transparent, plus out-of-network doctors that show up that you didn't plan for? So I certainly don't want this podcast to be doom and gloom, because we're going to tell you some ways of being able to get out of that. We want you to understand, to be forewarned is to be forearmed. So let's take a look at the fact that you and I didn't create the system, but we're part of it. And as being part of it, we're also victims of it, either if we allow ourselves to become that or because it's of circumstances outside of our control. So when you take a look at some of these cheap insurance policies that are being hawked, thanks to changes in how insurance can be sold and what can be included, if I were foolish enough, because finances dictated it, then I would get a policy that says, well, this gets rid of my maternity clause. At least I don't have to pay for maternity. Well, you're going to be paying for something, my friend. By the way, if you're a woman listening to this, you'd have a different view about that. The idea is policies are written to make sure that the company issuing that policy doesn't go broke. That means they want to be sure that they will cover what is important to cover as much as they can based on the premium that you'll be paying. Gray can address that.
What you have to realize is that there's always a finger pointed to insurance companies, but actually insurance companies are only half of all commercial insurance companies are run by the insurance company. And that's the other half is self-insured by the company that you work for. They're the ones that decide the coverage. So everybody points at just the insurance companies, but you have to point to your own employer. You have to understand your own insurance. People think that it's the insurance companies that are screwing you. Well, your own insurance company is causing these things too. So you got to understand who am I buying this insurance from? My employer, or am I buying it from an insurance company? Am I buying it from Medicare, or am I buying it from a commercial? And that's what you have to look at. I mean, about 10% of our population has no insurance at all. Those people are the ones that need to listen to this podcast. They're the ones that have to actually plan for this. They have to know when they go into a hospital that they can actually negotiate the price of the goods that they're getting. You know, remember what when you saw in the back of the hotel room, it was back of the door, it said rack rate. And you were staying in that room and it cost $100 and it said $495 rack rate. You're like, who the hell pays $495 for this room? That's crazy.
Well, the guy without insurance, that's who.
The guy that doesn't have, the lady that doesn't have insurance oftentimes is paying this high rate. But they have to know that by law, the hospital has to charge what's customary and reasonable for that particular operation, that particular visit. They can't charge the rack rate of $495. They got to charge what's customary and reasonable, which might be $200. So if they get this bill, they got to call up and say, I can't pay this. As soon as you get a bill that you can't pay, you get on the phone and you call your hospital. Like that day, even if you were unconscious when you went to the hospital, you got a $10,000 bill and you get the bill in the mail, you call them up and you talk with them. You tell them what poverty level you're at. You see what kind of a financial assistance they have for you. They can change that bill to zero if you ask them. If you don't ask them, don't call. They're going to assume that you owe it and can pay it. It'll go all the way to court.
Yeah, let me address another aspect. Let's say that one of your listeners has an accident. And let's say that they fit into reasonably well-paid positions, reasonably decent insurance. Well, when they check out of the hospital, the first thing that happens is the bill is generated and lands in your mailbox. The very first thing that you need to do is call the hospital up, if you're confused at all, and say, I want an itemized list of exactly what you're charging me for and what the price is. That alone will annoy the hell out of your hospital. But they are required to see that you get that full information. In our experience in collections, accounts assigned to collection agencies, close to a third of them have errors in them. Close to a third of them even have wrong addresses, and they even send the bill to the wrong people. So you've got to be alert. When that bill arrives, it is not anything more than the beginning of a process of you taking care of yourself. Now, let's say that everything's copacetic and you end up owing $20,000. It's going to be impossible for most people to pay $20,000, certainly not immediately. That's where you have to come up with your own money. You want to play on that, Craig, with what I'm saying?
Yeah. You have to know what level of spending, out-of-pocket spending for your medical debt or the debt that you owe from the past will put you into poverty or into hardship is what I call it. Hardship is just you can't do the things you did before. You can't eat the way you ate. You can't do your normal life the way you've been doing. Material hardship is where you can't pay your utilities. You can't pay the rent. You can't fix the car. You don't want to go to the doctor, things like that. Now, research shows us that when bills get to be 2.5% of your gross income, hardship starts to creep in. That's exactly the number, 2.5 to 3%, your hardship starts to creep in. At 5% to 10%, material hardship starts to creep in. So you as a consumer and as a debtor, someone that owes medical debt, has to understand your tolerance for out-of-pocket expenses. Some people, especially financially independent people that have saved and that understand that they can't live above their means, they might be able to pay 5 to 6%, 7% of their gross income to withstand a shock like a medical bill like this. But most people in this country can't even come up with $400 let alone not be in hardship. So 50% of the people can't come up with $400 without either increasing their debt or actually selling an asset.
Well, here's another statistic for you. What you're saying, Craig, is that if you have savings, you're in a better position to be able to manage payments and still keep a decent lifestyle. 15 million Americans this year, 15 million Americans will exhaust their life savings because of healthcare debt.
Now, let me add to this a little bit. The people that come to us for help, and we can't help individuals, we actually buy debt in big portfolios, like $100 million at a time. So a person that comes to us, we can't say, oh, we'll help you, we'll go find your debt. That's just too costly. We haven't figured a way to do that. But they'll come to me and say, I've got 10, 15 accounts that I can't pay, and the collection agencies are calling me and calling me. I had one lady that sent me 20 of her bills, and she did just like I said, call the collection agencies and work out payment plans. It turned out that she says, sometimes at the end of the month, I've paid too much to the collector. I said, well, you can't do that. So I tell people this. I say, take 2 to 3% of your gross income. So you're making $40,000. That's $800. Divide it by 12. We're talking about less than 80 bucks, I think. So that's the only amount that you can pay your collection companies that are calling you. And you tell each of them, I'm only going to spend 2% of my income, because if I don't, I'm going to go into hardship. You have to be your own best friend. No matter how many bills, no matter how much money, you have to be willing to only pay up until you're going to become in a hardship.
So, Craig, I want to follow up on what you were just saying, because I think there's something incredibly you're giving us the actual language that someone can use. So what I love about this is there's a problem, but I want to, in my mind, we've already pivoted to, as someone that knows the rules and knows the verbiage of the debt collection world, you have a way to now communicate and do so in a way that prevents hardship, and that they really won't. I mean, they may say no, but it's a lot less likely that they'll say no to, because you kind of understand their mental framework. So for instance, someone that has a pretty significant amount of savings, but knows at what point in time, what percentage in time we're now considered hardship, material hardship, et cetera. You can say, okay, based on my gross income, I can afford to send you 2 to 3% of my, and if I go above that, if I go above this 80 bucks a month, that's going to put me in hardship. That's going to put, and if you're a debt collector listening to that, you've already been conditioned and trained to think about that in a positive light. So, I mean, if am I understanding that right, Jerry? Help me, like, from a debt collector's perspective, when you get on the phone with this type of verbiage, what are they thinking?
The debt collector has one purpose, and that's to collect the bill. And they will do anything and everything that they can within their legitimate powers to be able to do that. The last thing that anybody who owns a collection agency does is to want to pay a debt collector for not being able to maximize the recovery that they're going after. So naturally, you're going to have a response. And the response is always going to be, well, you need to go out and borrow the money. Don't you have friends or relatives? You're responsible. I know you're a responsible person. And sending us 60 bucks a month for a $10,000 bill or a $5,000 bill, that's just not acceptable. So you're going to hear the implicit threats in that. And the threat is very real, because if that bill collector, whatever the policy is for that office, that they will only accept so much, they're in an interesting position as well. If they ask for too much or press too hard, you could very well go bankrupt and there goes all the money. Or you could very well stop all communication and turn it over to an attorney. That would be annoying for them. So my brothers and sisters in the collections industry would not be appreciative, but what I want you to know, almost automatically, when you get a call from a bill collector, you have 30 days in which to dispute the bill. I want you to dispute the bill.
Jerry, that's preposterous.
I know you see that from a bill collector background as well, Craig, but let me continue. You've got two guys that are running a charity, both former bill collectors, arguing about what's right or wrong about being a bill collector, while at the same time, our job is to help people get out from underneath their clutches and the monies that are owed. Is that not a challenge, my friends?
Man, that's life fantastic. Is a beautiful thing.
So, all right, guys, let's slow down just a real quick second here. I want to just put myself in the shoes of a listener. they get this bill, and there's some distinction between when the bill is getting collected by the hospital and versus a debt collector, as far as I understand it. So when you guys said the first thing you do is you call the hospital and say you can't pay. I think Jerry said the first thing you do also is ask for a list of itemized charges. Are there different concessions that you could expect from the hospital when it's within that original period versus once it gets to a debt collector? So talk me through the continuum of this.
One thing you have to realize is that there's only one collector for every 8,000 accounts at a hospital. So the chances of you ever being called by a hospital person are practically zero. The chances of you getting through to talk to a collector are probably very close to zero. You have to try, though. I would go to the hospital if you live close and actually talk with somebody. The problem is that there's only one financial aid counselor for every 50,000 accounts. So you got to do this as fast as possible, but you don't have to get it when it's with the hospital, because in 90 days, it's going to be placed with a collection agency. Like the 91st day, it will probably be placed with a collection agency, because that's the only way they can contact the patient. They don't have enough people to handle the calls even. So the first thing you have to do is you have to try to get to the hospital and tell them your situation. If it gets to a collection company, you still have time. The first collection agency is really the one that's calling up, is kind of light and easy. Did you get the bill? Do you have any problems? You know, we want to make sure that you're ready to pay. That's when you got to talk to them, because they can go back to the hospital and say, hey, this person qualified for your financial assistance policy, and they didn't tell you in the beginning, you need to reverse these charges to put it to charity care. That's the first part right there that you have to do.
And I would point out, by the way, that the collections industry is much maligned and not fairly so. What's the purpose of a business? Any business that you and I are in, the business that you're in, if you're billing somebody, you need to be paid for your goods or your services. You know why? Because you're paying other people whose goods and services you're using. So sometimes when you start a business, you're an entrepreneur, and you find out your cash flow is tight and nobody's responding to you, your mama didn't raise you up to be a bill collector. They might have raised you to be an entrepreneur or a hardworking individual, but not a bill collector. So that's where a third-party intervention comes in. And there are very responsible third-party collection agencies. There's even an association, a national association, American Collectors Association, that has rules and regulations and training classes. And of course, they're very carefully policed by the FDCPA. They have the law that came into effect in 1978, which was the year I started in collections. And it was brought out because there were such abuses. Today, the abuses are minimal, but there are agencies that exist that will be too aggressive and sometimes get outside the rules and regulations that are prescribed. Here's your process when you get hurt or sick. You go to the hospital, you get fixed. You go home, you get the first bill, second bill, third bill. If you haven't responded to those bills, and if no one's called you, depending, of course, on the size of the bill, then it's going to become a candidate for a collection agency. That's when the hospital, which is understaffed, can't turn into a bill collector. They're a hospital. So they turn it over to third parties. Third parties motivated by getting a percentage of what's collected. They're called contingencies. So the third party starts smiling and dialing, sending out letters. But in the first 30 days, by law, you can dispute that bill. And that's the part that I'm saying, that you need to dispute it immediately and then sort it out later. If you dispute it, what happens is that they have to go back to the provider and say, we're having a dispute. They don't understand the terms. They're too broke. There are things that are happening that they didn't understand. We need to fix this. Now, when the hospital and the bill collector get it fixed and they come back to you, it's going to be very difficult for you to dispute that. Now you've got to start talking about what you can or cannot do. If you don't have any money or you're not paying the bill collector, the next thing that happens, it goes back to the hospital. They send it out to a second agency, which is a little bit more aggressive and will be paid a little bit more. Why? because the hospital is not a bill collector. Now, at some point in time, some hospitals will give up, and at least a third of all hospitals in the United States will actually sell their debt to a debt buyer. The debt buyer will take possession of that bill for 4, 5, maybe 6, 7 cents on the dollar. But when they own it, it's no longer in the purview of the hospital to say yes or no to anything. They own that bill and they proceed to collect on it, not for the 6 or 7 cents, but for the full 100 cents on the dollar that your bill shows. Craig, you want to add to that?
Yeah, what that gives, the hospital gives them a cash flow that they didn't have. And they don't have to wait 2, 3, 4, 5 years from their collection agencies to get the money. So it's a way for them to get money right away. That right now is how we buy the debt. We buy the debt from the debt buyers, the ones that bought it for 5, 6, 10 cents on the dollar. And we buy it for less than 1% on the dollar because we've been able to identify of those accounts that they bought. These are the ones that really can't pay, will never pay. They would be worth something if they went to sell them because people will pay. But the problem is people will pay and will put them into hardship. So what we're trying to do is make sure that we take over the accounts that if they were to pay and if they stayed in the collection companies and the debt buyers, they would pay because people don't know how to say no.
I want to follow up on the RIP medical debt specifically in just a second. But before I go there, I think there's one like important thing that I'm noticing, and this is you guys are working at a macro level, but at the micro, at the individual. So this individual that was trying to work with the system, trying to work with a hospital, now their debt has been sold off and it's been bought for some pennies on the dollar, maybe 10 cents on the dollar, something like that. It's now just owned by this debt collection agency that is now pursuing it in full. It seems to me that much in the same way that you guys with this program, with this nonprofit are working at the macro level, there's probably still a chance for an individual who understands how things work to target their own debt with some of these strategies. Like for instance, yes, the collection agency is trying to collect 100 cents on the dollar, right? That they've bought, but at the same point, that's not where they're vested at. And to the same degree that they're willing to sell it, you know, to RIP medical debt for one single individual that's trying to manage this on their own. Do you see individuals being able to make the case using the verbiage like hardship, material hardship to say, is there a settlement amount? Does that happen?
Oh, sure. If I was in debt and I didn't have the money, but maybe I could raise some money, I would probably wipe out all of my debt by settling it. That's what I would do. You could easily settle things for 50%. It's a little harder to settle it for 40%. You can settle it for 30%. You might even get down to 5% or 10%, but you'd have to have reasons, or there'd have to be credible evidence as to why you're doing it. You have to give them an excuse or a reason to accept it. You can.
Well, there's another aspect to that. Keep in mind that the debt buyer who now owns your debt is pursuing that debt to make a profit. If you provide them details and information that you are insolvent, that you're in hardship, that you are 2 times the poverty level or below, the debt buyer is in business to make money, not to chase after bills he can't collect. That's where you're going to have your strongest ability to either have them forgive it or forget about it. They never forgive debt, but they will forget about it. They're not going to pick up the phone again and call you. So your job is to have a very credible story as to why they shouldn't spend more money to chase after you.
Well, put it this way too. It's the size of the account that determines whether or not something is going to be sued. Now, 1.5% of all workers in this country have a garnishment on their account for medical debt. That's because I would presume they ignored it, because most of those lawsuits came on what they call a summary judgment, meaning you never even showed up when you got a summons and complaint. And they have to hand this, a server has to hand you a piece of paper and said, I am serving you on this particular matter. They can't just send it in the mail and you don't get it. No, there's a process that has to go. If you don't go to the courthouse on that day, you now have a judgment against you. It morphs into a judgment that doesn't have anything to do with medical debt anymore. There's no disputing it anymore. There's nothing. It's now a pure legal matter that gets interest. So 1.5% of the people had judgments and have now a garnishment, which might be 10% of your income, 15% of your income. That, talk about a burden. Can you imagine? So go ahead, Jerry. What were you thinking?
Well, this is the shady side of the business. There are collection agencies. There are collectors who will practice what they call sewer service. They'll take the item they should be serving you with and drop it down the sewer. It never reaches you. And yet they will sign off that indeed on this date they presented it to you. And guess what? You're a victim of a misrepresentation. Well, let's just say the other side of it is you get the service and you don't show up. And why is that? Number one, you're scared. Everybody's afraid of going to court, and they should be. But I'd be even more frightened by not going to court, because I can guarantee you, percentage-wise, if you show up at court, the judge will look at what you owe and what they want compared to what you have as assets, and you will have that case. Many cases has been true. They'll simply cancel the debt out. I don't know the legal term for that. Do you, Craig?
No, I don't know what that would be unless it was a judgment and I would dismiss the judgment.
But dismiss the judgment,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Craig, I had a quick follow-up for you. So you said before that you could easily settle for 50%. Can you give us like the words to use or a script that you would say, all right, in your opinion, this is simple. They're going to accept this almost all of the time. Like, give us some actionable stuff for that easy settlement at 50%. Because I know I've had an issue with this. It wasn't a traditional insurance. It was a health share. So it was Liberty Health Share. And I received a balance bill and I tried repeatedly to get a settlement. And I was unsuccessful at more than like a 10 or 20% off the top. So it sounds like I did something wrong that I could have, if I had heard this, I would have saved myself a significant amount.
Well, your situation, every situation is different. I'm saying when you don't have the money, have no assets, and someone wants $20,000 from you, and you convince them that that's true by evidence, by how you talk with them. I don't know, however you decide to talk to a creditor or a collection agency or a debt buyer's collection agency. And if you can convince them the state that you're in, but then you say, I may be able to borrow it from my parents. I might be able to, I might be able to come up with it somehow. I might
do a Kickstarter campaign.
I could do a crowdfunding campaign. I could do something. And you say, if I was able to come up with, let's say you owe $10,000. If I somehow was able to come up with $3,000 on this bill, would your creditor accept it? And then just shut up. Like, I'll go back to my creditor. They have to go back to their creditor and they have to say, this is the person's situation. And if you've actually built a rapport with them, they start to trust what you say. And then now it's a matter of presenting it. And you even have to, if it's a creditor that you're talking to, let's say it's a collection agency you're talking to, and you still owe the hospital and they own it. Now it's a matter of having them, you and them working together to get the hospital to accept it. Mm. It's not them against you at all. It's you and the collection company are now going to figure out how can I present this to my boss, to your creditor, and tell them that this is the best thing we're going to get. And then that's it. Yes, Jerry.
Well, this is where people need backbone. It sounds strange, but you need a backbone when you're on the phone or you're in dialogue with a person who's asking you for money. I want to caution about another thing, and that is you need to remain civil at all times. The person that's calling you about that debt is paid to do his or her job. They're doing the best that they know how. To engage in anything other than a respectful conversation with them is not going to be to your advantage. Conversely, if you are subject to abuse, bad language, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act goes into effect. You write that piece of information down. You authenticate it in however fashion you can, and that collection agency will have a problem. So everybody wants to keep it at a high level. You do too. As far as negotiating, once again, there's different styles. I know some lady friends of mine who I wouldn't want to try to collect on. they would tear me up. So these are people that know their rights. They know what they're entitled to. And if they say, I can afford 50% and that's it, if you don't take it, then pretty much our conversation is completed. So come back and let me know if that works.
Now, one other thing that's interesting is a lot of the debt that's being collected is older. And each state has their own statute of limitations. Statute of limitations is the time that you can be forced to pay through a legal action. So let's take Connecticut, for example. There's a six-year statute, I believe. If let's say you had some work done in 2012, you had a hospital visit in 2012, $10,000. And now we're in 2019, past the statute of limitations. If you ever get a lawsuit, you have to go to the court and say, I have a defense. This case is out of statute. Like, you have a defense against the collections and they will not be able to get a judgment against you.
So I just want to clarify. So this lack of payment is going to tank your credit, right? But they cannot collect it past the statute of limitations. And am I correct in thinking that after maybe an additional period of time, it might even roll off as well, like 10 something odd years? Is that accurate?
Well, according to the credit reporting companies, your debt can only be put on for 7 years and then it comes off. If you go bankrupt, it's 10 years. But so 7 years from the date of service to the present day is as long as you can keep it on there. When a statute of limitation expires, it doesn't mean you don't owe it anymore. It means that if someone sues you, you can bring up a defense that it's out of statute. But they still could sue you, and you better know your rights. That's the unfortunate part of it.
Guys, well, they can sue you all day long, but when you walk to the court and you point out that this statute of limitations is supposed to eliminate that, and that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and all the laws are on your side, they can still call you up, they can still send you letters, but they can't institute legal pursuit. That's the thing you need to understand.
Only if you put forth your defense. If you don't go to the court, you'll have a judgment against you even 10 years. Hmm. So you got to know, when was this bill from? You can't get a judgment against me after it's out of statute. That's all.
I am so impressed with the quality and the content that you're bringing on this episode. And honestly, acting as consumer advocates in many cases, this has been unbelievable and it's so actionable. I feel like a lot of times I hear advice in the space and it's kind of just platitudes, but this is inside. This is what it really looks like. So I want to go ahead and pivot here. And I want to go back to how we started, which is Craig. Jerry introduced me. So I'm Craig. I'm working inside of, this debt collection service field. And Jerry introduced me to the idea that we could be forgiving this debt instead. And so let's send this to you, Jerry. Where did this idea come from on your end? What made you even think of this?
It may be hard for you to fathom, but you're talking to an activist. And I take great note of people in my world who are also activists. As part of that, I really appreciate the work that you guys are doing as activists to get people aware of what their rights are, what their privileges are, what they need to do on a protective basis while they're adding to their wealth and getting well. It's interesting. Bill collectors, when they chase down a bill and they collect it, they say that they've cured the bill. So we're talking about cures here, right? Well, some time back, I noticed that there was some activity where people had actually decided that they were going to do a debt forgiveness program. And I watched with interest with what was going on, and it didn't last very long. They did a pretty good job. But when I saw that that was disappearing, I went to my good buddy, Craig, and I said, Craig, you and I, with our background, with my activism and my fire in the belly, and your ability to take your collection agency software and re-engineer it, that instead of sending out collection letters, we can send out forgiveness letters. We know the debt buying industry. You know these people personally. Why don't we launch a program ourselves? Because it's a great idea. They just didn't have the expertise that we do. Now, why don't we put our expertise to good use? And Craig said,
that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Why would you do that?
Help
forgiving
people,
debt? I mean, are you nuts? But I said, well, I'll look at it, Jerry. And we ended up realizing how important the work is that we do. I mean, it was just astonishing going from a debt collector to a debt forgiver. I mean, it's a dream come true. It's practically miraculous that we are in this charity right now and about to abolish our $1 billionth. We are just blessed.
Well, let's give you some history about how fortunate we've been. When we first started it, we assumed that everybody would think this would be a great idea and they would donate money and then we would be doing good things. It couldn't be further from reality because we struggled. We struggled for the first year and a half or better. We ourselves became qualified under our own forgiveness, either being 2 times poverty level or below, or we were in hardship. And frankly, it's a couple of times you could say that we were insolvent, but we had one thing going for us, and that is we don't quit. And providentially, because we didn't quit and we were doing everything we could to get some awareness of what we were doing and how we were doing it, one of the original people with RIP Medical Debt was Robert Goff, who was a former executive director of the NYU Physicians Association. And he and I decided to write a book. And the title of the book is The Patient, the Doctor, and the Bill Collector, an Obamacare and Medical Debt Collection Survival Guide. And by the way, I might as well tell your audience that they do want to be educated. Why don't you go to the people who wrote the book? So this is called The Patient, the Doctor, and the Bill Collector. Well, we wrote the book. We didn't expect to make $1 million. We just needed to have a very expensive calling card so people would realize that we did have authority in that world. Well, it so happened that that book was sitting on the desk of an attorney here in New York City when the John Oliver HBO program Last Week Tonight called him up and said, we have a problem. And the problem was that the Oliver people had very carefully and capably set up an organization that would be able to abolish debt, but not quite to the rigors of what you would expect of a charity. So when it was determined by HBO that, you know, there's something called HIPAA involved here, there's something called patients' rights and not violating them, we can't go making a comedy show out of this. And so when they called around to find out what they could do, this book was lying on the desk of that attorney. And she turned to chapter 10, which says, got medical debt? Let's forgive it. And she says, these are the people you need to talk to. So that's when John Oliver's people gave me and Craig an invitation to the HBO headquarters. We sat down with them. Every question they had, we had the answers. We were a 501c3. And we, by law, as a charity, can forgive debt at no tax consequences to the recipient. And when they learned that, that's when the John Oliver experience came about, which made the most huge difference in our lives.
I'll be honest, that was my first exposure to what you guys were doing. Really, really incredible stuff. And the thing is, wiping out close to, I think we're here, but it's, you know, probably, I think honestly, as we might be along with you guys on this journey to watch you guys walk over this $1 billion threshold here. We're that close, but it's to say that it did not take $1 billion of contributions in order to get us here. You guys are able to do this because of the numbers on 1%, right? I mean, that's effectively what we're talking about here. It's 1 to 100 based on the relationships that you cultivated, the insider access that you have to this. I mean, how are you able to get this incredible return? You were talking about Brad couldn't even get 10% off. You know, an average person with actual material hardship could make a case for 50% off. You're able to do this at the peak of efficiency, 1 to 100. How is that possible?
Well, it's numbers. It's volume. You do it on volume. I mean, if I went to a hospital and said, I've got a person here that's in material hardship. She has no income. She owes $1,000. We're a charity. We're going to give you $10. They'd laugh me out the house, you know, like, are you kidding me? But if I put 1,000 of them together, and now I have $1 million worth of accounts and I'm going to give them $10,000, they're going to say, now you add another 1,000 times that, now we're talking about significant money. I mean, the last buy we just did was $119 million of debt. So you're bringing in $100,000 bills for millions of dollars and $10 million, as opposed to $10 for $1,000. So it's all about volume. It's all about relationships. They're not going to sell their debt to just anybody. There's only about 5 to 10 debt buyers that buy all the debt in this country for medical debt, because the hospitals have to know who they're doing business with. They don't even allow those debt buyers to sell it to another debt buyer. They're allowing them to sell it to us as a charity, but they're not allowing it to be resold to another collection company that they don't know. So they really have to get to know the collection company. And collection companies these days will work out a plan with anybody. If you're dealing with a company that will not work with you, you ought to call that hospital and say, this collection agency is not doing its job. It's not helping me. I mean, helping me resolve my problem to the best of my ability without going into material hardship. Maybe it's okay for me to go to hardship one month, maybe two, but I'm not going to go into material hardship to pay. I shouldn't have to. That's where we're at and why we can do what we do.
So guys, what does this look like in the months that follow this amazing exposure on HBO? Just doing back of the envelope math, if you paid off $900 million of debt at 1 to 100, it's about $9 million in donations you guys have received, you know, plus or minus, again, back of the envelope. Did that all come essentially post the Oliver Show? Like, talk us through what that is like for you.
When the Oliver Show came, we didn't know what to expect. And we didn't even demand that they put us on the show. We actually said, you guys do what you think is best. We care more about the debt abolishment, because he abolished $15 million with us on the show. So we cared more about that than being exposed. Although I did say we would be quite disappointed if we didn't, but we're not putting it in the contract that you must.
What we said is, you know, it sure would be nice, you know, if we were mentioned. And, you know, it's not the policy of that show to advertise people. So it was a little bit unlikely that we would be mentioned. But when it came to pass, my wife and I were sitting here in Manhattan watching TV. We had a split of champagne between us, so that if indeed RIP medical debt was mentioned, we would pop the cork and celebrate.
You were ready. Well, I like it.
We were ready for it. So 25 minutes of a 30-minute show was spent castigating bill collectors and, oh, I tell you, I wouldn't want to be a debt buyer bill collector listening to that show. And then at the very end, he decides that what really is going to happen is he's going to out Oprah. Instead of giving away $7 million for the cars, he's going to give away $15 million for the medical debt. And he's choosing this charity, RIP Medical Debt. And our logo appears above his shoulder. He hits a big red button. Money comes down from the ceiling. And our website crashes.
Well, I was in charge of the website, so that was not too cool.
Oh, but, my goodness. Are you ready?
So what was ironic is that I was doing work out of my basement. Jerry's doing it out of his apartment. My wife is being my secretary, making sure I got back to all the people that are calling. I mean, we got thousands of interested people getting in touch with us. We got hundreds and hundreds of donations. We had Australian broadcast company, ABC, wanted to do a documentary on us. We were in the front page of the New York Times. I did a Guardian op-ed. We had people from the UK calling us. We raised over $200,000+ from that, which was 10 times as much as we had ever raised in our first 2.5 years. So it became that we could actually start to abolish debt. I think at that point we had about $700,000 of debt.
$700,000.
Now we're at $15,700,000. And then we were able to abolish another $3 million, $4 million. And then the next year, so we went from being a nothing. I think we raised $2,000, $3,000 the first 6 months. And then we raised $20,000. And then in 2016, we raised $200,000+. The year after that, we raised $2.5 million. The year after that, we raised $5.5 million. This year, we'll probably raise almost $10 million. So it's a hockey stick type of growth because people just, they can't even believe that you could give $1 and get $100 of debt abolished. It's just not found this multiplier effect where that $10 million could abolish debt for 300,000 people. 300,000 people.
Wow.
Just for our audience, I'm reading an article here. It's yesmagazine.org. There, it's a profile on you guys dated back 2015. So it's a little bit out of date now, but I think it's really important to say that these aren't just numbers. These are people's lives. And in this article, it starts by talking about a Miss Gonzalez who received a phone call from RIP Medical Debt. She was certain that she'd heard a mistake, a prank maybe. The caller says a $950 hospital bill has been paid in full. It would not affect her credit and she wouldn't have to worry about it again. They just wanted to pay the bill for me. Now, in this case, Ms. Gonzalez shares in this article that she has lupus. It's a chronic autoimmune disease. Got it in 2011. It put her in and out of hospitals. Even with insurance, she has a barrage of medical bills that just have to get put to the side. She can't always work. She'll be fine one day, sick the next. The fact that somebody, this external force, would come in without prompting, and I mean, it changed her life. And I think, you know, and Craig, I believe, or in Jerry, in your words, in the same article, people having to, in many cases, make this choice. They're sitting at the kitchen table and they're having to decide, do I buy medication today or do I pay the water bill or do I pay the debt collector? And for you guys to basically come in and remove the debt collector from this situation, that's impact. And it's something that, I mean, Brad has been excited about this idea for a long time. It's one of the reasons we're having you on the show to inspire and excite other people. And it's one of the ways that we're just looking to partner with you in any capacity possible. So I think for us as individuals, but also to reflect, I think many people in our audience, we want to get involved. We want to have an impact. We want to just see, we want more good to happen in the world. We want to be activists. What does it look like for us to be able to help you in any way we can? What do you have for us?
Well, let me thank you for identifying the reason that we exist. And the reason why you guys are so excited is because it's about people. I'm the one who made the phone call to that young lady. And she wasn't sure she was talking to the right person. You're going to what? And indeed, those kinds of feelings, the good kind of feelings, are transferable. They're shareable. And the donors that come to us are people, and they range from high school students in Pensacola, Florida, who raised money for about $3 million of the medical debt in their area, to a couple ladies in the Finger Lakes District who raised a bunch of money to draw attention to their campaign for health care. We have the faith-based community. God bless them. The faith-based people said, you know what? What would Jesus do? And so we have literally some 60 churches lined up saying, I want to do a campaign. So let me explain the difference between a random act of kindness and a campaign. If your listener wants to make a random act of kindness and donate to RIP Medical Debt, just go to our website, ripmedicaldebt.org, and there are ways of being able to donate to us. And that's random. That means we will take that money, put it into a pool, and go out and buy debt anywhere. And they will have participated in this wonderful debt forgiveness program that we do. And then there are people who say, well, I want to be a little bit more formal about this. I want to really let people know the importance that they hold for us in our community, that we are responsible for our brothers and sisters in some wonderful fashion called forgiveness. And that's where people create a campaign. Now, a campaign, basically the bottom line of a campaign is that there's $15,000 that's contributed on up by an organization and or an individual, and they say, what can $15,000 get me in the way of debt forgiveness in Toledo, Ohio, or in the Appalachia, or in my hometown? And if we have debts that's available for them, we come back and say, guess what? You just got rid of about $1.5 million worth of someone's medical pain. So like with you guys or with anybody who wants to contact us and say, look, it, I want to do a campaign. I think I can pull together this $15,000. And what does it do again? $1.5 million worth of medical debt abolished. Plus, we go into a publicity campaign to make sure that the local newspapers know that these people are doing the good that they are doing.
All right, so Brad, I think we want to do a campaign.
Yeah.
Right? I don't want to do one. I'm in. All right, guys. I tell you what, let's continue this conversation offline and we will figure out what a campaign would look like. And maybe we can talk about it on our Friday roundup and give our listeners more input if they want to join us on this. But I know that we want to be a part of that. I mean, for 100% certain.
That's great. Thank you. That would be absolutely amazing.
Awesome.
Beyond amazing. And it's very much in keeping with your credo. How in the world can you be independent if you're submerged by medical debt that you can't pay? So you guys are providing remedies and we want to thank you for that.
All right. To our audience, first of all, Craig, Jerry, thank you so much for coming on the show. To our audience, if this excited you, if you're excited both about the information from an inside perspective that you receive, but also having an impact at a mass scale, and you want to join us on this endeavor, we'll roll out all the details on the Friday roundup. But if you want to nip straight to it and find it out, we are going to have a way that you can partner with us at choosefi.com/RIP. All right, my friends, if you got value from today's episode, and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. Just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us in what we're doing here at ChooseFI, I tell you what, just go to choosefi.com/RIP. All right, my friends, we'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.